This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. Let me see if I can figure out what I did with my glasses. I'm just leaving the church. I'm going to move this a little bit, get it squared up. There we go. That's better. So I just dropped by the church to help get things set up for Sunday. And I'm heading home at this point. It's been a good week. We've been able to accomplish some things at work. We have an exciting week coming up next week. I am watching because it's not, my side of the fence, but we are doing a major upgrade on one of our server that runs all our workflow stuff, but we've done some other upgrading and it seems to be fine, and this will get us set up so that we can go ahead and relicense our servers for another probably 3 years. So that all, it looks good and looks fine. And there's always lots and lots and lots of things to do. And lots of things to get done, but that's okay. It's all billable hours. It's interesting. I don't know if I should be talking about this at this point, but now that I'm at a year and 11 months, I sort of look at the whole thing and think about retirement some more and look at the whole thing. And I mean, there are some definite advantages monetarily to waiting until you're 70. And now that I'm this close, it's once I get to retirement age, which is 66 and 8 months, that's like, just 3 years and 4 months away from being 70. And so we'll see how much is left to be done. We'll see what needs to be done. It'll just be interesting to see how it all goes and where we are. And step at a time. Costumes are fine. I've been doing a little checks and tweaks on the angel costume. That's in 2 weeks, being Angel Day. And so got the wings down from being hung up in the ceiling of my office. Got them down where I can work with them. Charged up the battery on them. They still seem to work. Yay. Got that charged up, and I'm replacing the vest out. What I had for a vest was an actual underbust corset, and my wife said that, she said, well, it's pretty obvious what that is, and I said, that's fine, sweetie, and so she said, yeah, I'm a little uncomfortable with that. Okay, that's fine. So I got a vest that was also brocade, and it just a little more masculine there, so whatever that means. But I need to put slits in the side so I could, the wings have shoulder straps, but they also have a waist strap that stabilizes everything. And instead of just wrapping around that around the outside, what I do is I put a couple of slits on the side of whatever vest I'm wearing, and that way I can feed the strap underneath in front and kind of provides a more finished look. I did have a little amusing encounter on Saturday last week because I had done International Cat Day, and that was fun. People enjoyed that. I, out of the blue, saw a friend in Cracker Barrel who is one of the church parishioners, and I had seen him. His name was Sam, and I went, hey, Sam, and so we chatted for a little bit, and I did some of the bit and all that kind of thing, and he saw me Sunday, and it's kind of those spheres crossing together. Once I'm at church and I'm at friends with church, I'm not really thinking that much about the costumes. And he said, so did you make that costume you were in? And I was like, what are you talking? I was, and then I thought, oh, hey, I did see you. And I said, yeah, well, I said, I put it together. I ordered some pizzas. And he said, because that really looked pretty professional. I said, well, thanks, you know. I said, you know, you get some pre-made pieces and you put them together and then you do some of your own detailing and customization on it. And I think it kind of ties it all together because I had a name badge and I had put some lettering on my little portable incarceration unit because it was cat day and I was supposedly an agent of riffraff. And I think I talked about that last week. So, and if I didn't, you can find it on my Facebook feed. So that was kind of fun, seeing somebody kind of out of the blue and trying to get that all put back together, but everyone seemed to enjoy the, International Cat Day, and this week is National Elvis Week, so, you know, I have such a horrible wig, it's so horrible, it's just hysterically horrible. So anyways, Barbie is supposedly going to show up, my costume buddy. She's supposedly going to show up as Elvis on Saturday as well, so that should be fun. So all is well there. I did land book 19 yesterday, so I'm starting my read through tonight. Got about a week and a half of read through, and then get everything laid out. And then try to figure out what we're doing for a cover, get some costumes in for the kids. And I've got to kind of figure out the cover soon, because I've got to order costumes for the kids and make sure that I have time to get them in. And then we'll see if we can get a beta copy put together of all this, hopefully sometime early September, so I can order books and get them in, you know, like third week, fourth week of September, get the books out to people. So that's coming up. So all that's fine and well and working. I did try something a little bit different this week that I think is going to work well. I've been doing 2 40-plus-hour fasts a week. So I've been stopping eating on Sunday night, having a Tuesday night meal, and then starting eating again on Thursday night. And the more that I've been reading and listening about multi-day fast, there were really good things that are starting to kick in at about 2.5 days. And I'm like, well, this is kind of a bummer. So I decided this week that what I would do is I would stop eating Sunday night and then start eating Wednesday night, which puts me at about a 72-hour fast. As it turns out, it was about 70 hours, but, you know, it's close enough. And it wasn't bad at all. It was just fine. So what that means is I do eat Wednesday night, and then if I go out for breakfast with a friend on Thursday, I can go ahead and eat then, and then I wait till the evening to eat. I had made some chicken cracklins. I got some chicken skins from a butcher and cooked them up, and it was fine. They were good. It's just chicken skin and you cook it till it's crispy, you know. But then I discovered Walmart has pork cracklins, and it's basically the same thing. It's just fat and salt is all it is. And I thought, well, shoot. So I got a bag of those. I don't know exactly what kind of oil they're cooked in, so I gotta find that out. But I'm working my way through the bag, and they're pretty good, and there's no carbs in those, so depending on what type of oil it is, if they're cooking it in soybean oil or something, then that's not gonna work. But yeah, so maybe I found some manufacturer who might be manufacturing something that isn't too terrible. And maybe I can just use them. So we'll see. This week I came across a podcast. And I have made the statement in the past that the medical industry killed my friend. Killed as in killed. That their negligence and greed and incompetence in varying measures among the personnel that my friend encountered, they actually killed him when there was no reason for him to die of COVID. And I based a lot of that on ivermectin and the fact that they would not give him ivermectin. That they, one doctor specifically said, well, that's a dog dewormer and I'm not giving that to my human patients, which is an utterly ignorant and uninformed statement. It's completely ignorant. And what it means is that this doctor didn't have the good grace or the diligence to bother to investigate. They just took what they were told, which, you know, talking heads is not necessarily what we want in doctors. We would prefer not to have talking heads, that they would actually be looking at things. I'm getting my mail. One moment. I've been looking for my Medicare card, and I haven't seen it yet. And if it doesn't come in soon, I'm just going to have to order another one, because I need to get signed up for whatever Advantage or supplement plan that I'm going to get. I am signed up for Medicare at this point, so yay, that's coming in 3 months. So got August, September, and October, and then I'm on in November, so yay. Anyways, I have made the claim in the past that they killed my friend, because I firmly believe if ivermectin had been easier to get, if vitamin C had been stressed more, that my friend Chris Hill would not be dead. But I came across another blog, and that just reinforced the fact that the medical industry, through greed and negligence and incompetence, killed my friend, and he did not have to die. And I wasn't aware of this backstory, but I think it illustrates once again that the medical industry has been captured, and that what we have from the medical industry is this very sad state now, where, frankly, I don't trust the medical industry at all. You know, if I have a broken leg or something like that, then, you know, I'll let them fix that, because they are very good at that. But when it comes to my health and anything that is a day-to-day kind of governance type thing with figuring out what I'm going to eat, what medications I'm going to take, etc., 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 I'm not going to let the medical industry have any part in that. I will make my own decisions. I will do my own thing. And that is in large part because of the responses, in some part because of the responses that I saw during the COVID pandemic, in large part because of finally coming to a better understanding that what happened in COVID was in fact not unusual and was standard operating procedure as it had been for decades. And this is just another story about standard operating procedure for the medical industry. So, this podcast was on Brett Weinstein, and it was called Pharma, Not Their First Rodeo. And he was interviewing Umberto Maduri and Paul Merrick. Now, Paul Merrick was part of the COVID Frontline Alliance, which I really learned a lot about ivermectin by go visiting their sites. But Umberto Maduri is a professor of pharmaceutical sciences and a former professor of medicine at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center in Memphis, Tennessee. Paul Merrick is eminently qualified. He's from Johannesburg. He's certified in internal medicine, in critical care medicine, in neurocritical care, in nutrition science, advanced degrees in pharmacology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, these are eminently qualified men. Well, so back in the year 2000, Umberto, his last name is Maduri, they were doing some research and they discovered that when the body has accelerated states of inflammation, that you could ameliorate that inflammation with corticosteroids. And it was important to do that because if the body is in extreme state of inflammation, such as when you get a cytokine storm because you've had lung respiratory issues, if you are in that inflammation state for too long, apparently it gives rise to pleasant homes for bacteria and you get all kinds of bacteriological infections and those infections kill you. So you do not want your body to be in this heightened state of inflammation, really heightened state of inflammation, for days and days and days because it will kill you. And the standard treatment for when you get in that heightened state of inflammation, if it's in your lungs and you can't breathe, is to put you on a ventilator, which just greatly increases your chances that you are going to die. So what had happened, and I'll just give you the synopsis, what had happened in the case of Umberto Maduri, he was part of a group that was doing research and had discovered that if you used corticosteroids, that you could reduce the fatality rate by 50%. That's pretty significant, 50%. And they had proved this in SARS and in a few of the other respiratory diseases that had come along at that amount of time. And they had discovered that there were, you know, some important guidelines. One of them was, and they said it wasn't original with them, was that if you give corticosteroids, one of the things that you should do if you give them that elevated doses is after you come off them, you should taper off them gradually. Because if you are giving heightened doses of corticosteroids, your body is going to say, oh, I don't need to manufacture that stuff. So it cuts back on its manufacturing. And then if you do an abrupt stop to it, then the body can't get caught up fast enough. And you can die from that, so that's not good. But anyways, so 20 years ago, they found that there's a respiratory something, RDS, it's called RDS. 20 years ago, we do address that question. We found that a very interesting, that we found those with RDS that develop pneumonia, that is a common complication for patients and mechanical ventilation where the defenses you have of the upper airway sector are gone. And in essence, what's more common in patients with high levels of inflammation. So the question was, how is it possible that I have more pneumonia when inflammation is high and inflammation is the one thing supposed to kill you? And he said, what he summarized was that the patient was not dying from the pneumonia because the prediction of death was available based on inflammation levels. So people have inflammation, they get pneumonia, they get RDS, and they found that there was an excessive growth of bacteria in the midst of this inflammation. And so then they did a randomized study in people with RDS, and they saw a reduction and a survival rate, very good survival rate. So anyways, so they're putting together guidelines in March of 2020. And, well, they're putting together guidelines for all this kind of stuff. There are other studies that are putting together. And they're, you know, trying to get published to say, ha ha, look, look, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Well, during this time, Eli Lilly is also developing a drug for inflammation in the lungs. And the paper that Eli Lilly submits to one of these journals, it was like maybe the New England Journal of Medicine, I think. Eli Lilly submits their paper, and this other study submits their findings with the corticosteroid. Mm-hmm. Corticosteroids are not under patent anymore, are cheap. Lo and behold, the New England Journal of Medicine delays the publication of the corticosteroid paper. They publish the Eli Lilly study, and on the basis of that and other things, Eli Lilly gets approved by the FDA for this drug. As it turns out, later, there's more studies that are done, and the drug is not effective. It's no better than a placebo, and it's discontinued. But with this competition in the market, then the World Health Organization and the FDA and the CDC all come out and recommend against using corticosteroids for inflammation in the lung. And that stands to today. They continue to say, don't do that, that it's toxic. Well, the reason they're saying it's toxic is because there were some studies that greatly overdosed patients and then abruptly cut them off from the corticosteroids. And of course, there were bad outcomes then. And so on the basis of those, then WHO and the CDC and the FDA all say, oh, no, you can't use corticosteroids. They're toxic when, you know, you've got all these inflammations in your lungs. And of course, you know, these studies came out at a very convenient time when it was really beneficial for the pharmaceutical companies to prove that corticosteroids don't work. And this is a common tactic that the pharmaceutical companies figure out how to rig a trial, and then they do a trial, and then they trumpet CEC, it doesn't work. And then they get the WHO and the FDA and the CDC to come out and say, yep, see, it doesn't work. Don't recommend this. Because corticosteroids, like ivermectin, would have cut into their business and they wanted to develop their own drugs. So basically, since the early 2000s, you've got this prohibition by leading medical entities to not use corticosteroids. And there's this condition called ARDS, I forget what this stands for, that according to this doctor, Umberto Maduri, there's 200,000 patients a year, and the mortality rate is about 35%. So 70,000 people are dying in the hospital per year. And if you look at the one-year survival rate, it goes up to 100,000 people because the people that are in the hospital are put on ventilators, and ventilators are very, very hard on the body. So this is every year. You've got 100,000 people who are dying from this inflammation of the lungs, and they're not being given corticosteroids. Because the WHO and the CDC and blah, 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 based on trials that were most likely rigged by the pharmaceutical companies, they're not being given that, even though there have been multiple studies that show that you could cut that mortality rate in half, both for the people who are on ventilators and before the people would ever get to the ventilators. If they would start them on rounds of corticosteroids, that you could save half of those people. So we're talking about 50,000 people a year, conservatively, just from this one disease over a 20-year period. And the reason that this is close to my heart is because I happened to see enough information on Paul Merrick's website Paul Merrick and Pierre Corey's website that I saw that they were recommending that when a patient gets COVID and you're 7-8 days into it and your body is cleaning out that virus, you have enough spike proteins that some people are going to go into one of these cytokine storms and you're going to start losing your ability to breathe. You're going to lose your ability. There's so much inflammation in your lungs that you're going to lose your ability to get oxygen. And it's a very clear progression. Unfortunately, I had not read up enough by the time Chris Hill became infected with COVID and got into an inflammation state that was a cytokine storm. I had not read enough at that point to be able to recommend anything to him. I was already on the ivermectin bandwagon, and I had been telling him about it and telling him about it. And he, once he got, you know, kind of deep into trouble where he couldn't breathe, he was able to get some ivermectin from one of the clinics in town. But, you know, by that time, he only got one dose in, and he just got to the place where he couldn't breathe. And so he ended up in the hospital. Of course, then they ventilated him, and he hung on for weeks. But once he got into the hospital complex, they weren't going to hear anything else besides, oh, well, we'll just give him antibiotics and we'll just keep him on the ventilator and maybe he'll pull out. So at some point around that time, you know, I got more familiar with the role of corticosteroids and what the recommendations were and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And because I had gotten to be aware of that, it was sort of around that time, little after that, my wife and I came down with COVID. And my wife had it for 5 days. She thought it was allergies. She kept thinking it was allergies until she finally took a test. And then, no, she tested positive. Well, I had been around her for 5 days, so of course I came down with it. So as soon as I started getting symptoms, I had already been pre-dosing with ivermectin. I just went on double doses of ivermectin. I put her on double doses of ivermectin. We put her mother on double doses of ivermectin. And Net got the monoclonal antibodies. And in spite of all that, there came a point where Lynette's blood oxygen level started to drop. And once it got down into the low 90s, I knew enough at that point that I looked at her and I said, sweetie, you need to call your doctor right now and get a corticosteroid inhaler. Thankfully, Lynette had bouts with bronchitis, and the particular doctor she had prescribed a corticosteroid inhaler for her for those things. So when she called her doctor and just said, I need a corticosteroid inhaler, the doctor just prescribed it. She started using that. It was rapid. Her blood ox levels started to come back up. You know, they didn't go down any further. It took care of the problem. So not only do we have this thing that's been going on for decades where people who could be helped by a cheap and effective medication have been denied that, when we had a global event that caused precisely the type of conditions that corticosteroids could help, the medical establishment said, no, you can't use that. Not because there was not studies that showed that was effective, But A, because there were studies that were most likely manufactured to show that it wasn't effective and that it was toxic. And B, because there was a suppression and the medical establishment and the industry did not want people knowing that you could get something as cheap as a corticosteroid inhaler and make significant impact. And there were other ways to make this exact same significant impact. There, I was listening to a South African doctor who was out in the boonies, 35 kilometers from the nearest hospital. And as he worked with his patients firsthand, he saw that they all started losing their ability to breathe about 7 to 8 days after they contracted the virus. And he reasoned to himself, oh, this must be some sort of histamine response because your body has all that foreign material in it from the spike proteins. And so he just started prescribing antihistamines, just plain old antihistamines to knock down the level of infection. And when the interviewer asked them, and he had treated hundreds of patients, and when the interviewer asked him, so how many of your patients had to go to the hospital? And he said, well, you have to understand we're 35 kilometers away and people don't like the hospitals, so they don't want to go to the hospital. And the interviewer said, all right, well, how many of your patients died? And the answer was zero. Zero. Because he paid attention. He was a doctor. He prescribed what became crystal clear to him by simply working with his patients. So, yeah. This whole industry that has been captured by pharma and has specifically been captured by pharma to sell as many drugs as it possibly can to us without regard to what those drugs might do to our health. Just want to stick it in your arm or get you to swallow something. And it doesn't really matter how many people it kills. It doesn't really matter how much the denial of effective medicines results in people dying. All that's important is that the machine keeps running. And the machine does run and run and run and run. And it's the same thing over and over and over and over. I would like to think the COVID pandemic is going to make a difference. I would like to think that there's going to be some sort of change that there's, but I don't think there is. And it's not just the United States health industry. You know, it's all the Western world's health industries. And on rare occasions, you have some government entity somewhere that says, yeah, we're not doing that. You know, like Florida saying, we're not going to stay shut down. Like Sweden saying, you know what, we're going to stay open. We're going to protect those who are most at risk, et cetera, et cetera. But it really is a sad state of affairs. And if I didn't have enough to convince me that the medical industry, through their incompetence and their greed and their ignorance, killed my friend, Chris Hill. This is just another story in that saga of, yes, there was no reason for Chris to die. He just got caught inside the medical industry and its capture by Big Pharma. This is Phil Farrand, and I have made it home.